All right, well, let's kick off. Sorry about the delay, everyone. My name is Khaled Fatal. I'm the chairman of the MLI Group and the publisher of Survivority News. Today's topic is it okay for the FBI to secretly hack your company to remove alleged Russian malware? The reason why we're talking about this today is because there is a news story that just came out, and we will dig into that, that talks about this, that the FBI did actually secretly hack into companies' servers for the purpose, so that the storyline and the article talks about, to remove malware that supposedly Russian cyber hackers have planted. The question here is, we need to determine, is this okay? And to what level should we really demand a minimum level of transparency in what our security agencies do what they do? And this will be a serious topic of conversation this afternoon or this morning or wherever you are. And I do ask you to, if you have any questions or thoughts you want to share, please write them down so at least you prepare them, because I'm going to give the floor to the audience to do that. Sam, please, can you take the floor and share with us the article that prompted this by the New York Times?
Hi, everyone. Yes, so the topic of discussion is prompted by the article which appeared in New York Times. And this is what this article says. The article says that the United States said that they secretly removed malware from computer networks around the world in the recent weeks, which was a step to preempt Russian cyber attacks and send a message to Russian President Vladimir Putin. And this move was made public by Attorney General Merrick Garland, and it comes as US officials warned that Russia could try to strike American critical infrastructure, including financial firms, pipelines, and the electric grid, in response to the crushing sanctions that the United States has imposed on Moscow over the war in Ukraine. This malware enabled the Russians to create botnets, or networks of private computers, which are infected with malicious software and controlled by the GRU, or the intelligence arm of the Russian military. But it is unclear what the malware actually was intended to do, since it could be used for everything from surveillance to the actual destructive attacks. So an American official said on Wednesday that the United States did not want to wait to find out what that malware was supposed to do, and they were armed with secret court orders in the United States and with the help of the governments around the world, the Justice Department and the FBI disconnected these networks from the GRU's own controllers. So the statement from the Attorney General, Mr. Garland, was that fortunately we were able to disrupt this botnet before it could be used. The court orders allowed the FBI to go into domestic corporate networks and remove the malware, sometimes without the company's knowledge. President Biden has repeatedly said that he would not put the US military in direct conflict with the Russian military, a situation he has said could lead to World War III. That is why he refused to use the US Air Force to create a no-fly zone over Ukraine, or to permit the transfer of fighter jets to Ukraine from NATO's air bases. But his hesitance does not appear to extend to cyberspace. The operation that was revealed last Wednesday showed a willingness to disarm the main intelligence unit of the Russian military from computer networks inside the United States and around the world. It is also the latest effort by the Biden administration to frustrate Russian actions by making them public before Moscow can strike. Even as the United States works to prevent Russian cyber attacks, some American officials fear that Mr. Putin may be biding his time in launching a major cyber operation that could strike a blow at the American economy. That is the what the article says. And what is your reflection on this, Khalid?
It's not a good time. In fact, I actually, first of all, thank you for making us aware of what the article in the New York Times talks about. There are clearly numerous issues that we need to dig into, and here's the underpinning as to why these topics are critical. Let's be clear. Here in the, those of us who live in a Western democracy, whether you are in Europe, the US, North America, Canada, we claim to hold ourselves to a much higher level of transparency, accountability, because we claim to be democratic. So what can, I don't expect somebody who lives in a banana republic to expect that level of transparency of accountability by public officials. What concerns me from this is the following. The fact that the FBI is reported to have secretly hacked into the servers of companies around the world. We're not talking about American companies, but servers around the world. To remove what is alleged to be malware planted by someone, this raises at least one concern. We don't know who planted those malware. Let me just put something in context here. When we talk about cyber warfare and cyber attacks, a critical topic, critical component is attribution. Attribution, for those who don't know what that means, it means who did it. Now, in forensics, when we hear about people who commit murders or whatever, the police can actually find evidence that can really be almost 100% certain this is the person who did it. Sometimes you have a video, sometimes you have witnesses. In cyber, if anyone tells you that they have the ability to create or define attribution to who did something perfectly or 100%, you can tell them, I told you, to call them a liar. In cybersecurity, in the cyberspace, there's no such a thing as 100% capability to determine attribution. In fact, what is even more worrying here is often very smart hackers can leave breadcrumbs to lead the forensic experts who are investigating a particular attack to conclude somebody did it, not somebody else. So why I raise this issue is because we have seen numerous examples over the years where our law enforcement agencies in Western democracies lead us astray or even lie to us. So let me give you an example. So for example, a string, not just a lie. We've all heard about the alleged cyber attacks of the US elections in 2016. Till now, the public has not been informed or given any evidence of that happening. The only thing that's been offered is statements by heads of national security law enforcement agencies who say, yes, we believe or we are confident it was Russia. Now, it may have been Russia, but my ability to question and my determination to question is because we in Western society have been lied to before and we have been duped before. Case in point, the war on Iraq. How many times we heard that Saddam had weapons and the intelligence agencies, blah, 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 and guess what? More than a million people died, and not even an apology. All they say, well, we had the wrong information. With cyber, we don't know unless we are given the evidence and we are holding our public officials to account to be able to determine whether it was really Russian malware. The malware was deposited by Russian operators, and if that's the case, guess what? Share this with me and see me fight on your side, because this is wrong. But if you want to tell me that I have to trust you because you're going to go in and remove the malware, how do I know you haven't planted anything else? How do I know it was not another intelligence agency of the same country who planted it and left breadcrumbs that it's supposed to be another country. So it leaves us wondering, because you have a track record of lying and duping us, and now we're seeing a lot of this manifesting itself. Something else that came out in the story, which is the public statements by the U.S. officials talking about the U.S. sanctions on Russia, calling it crushing. I think if any of you joined the last session we did a week ago on the topic of, is the cyber war between Russia and I'm paraphrasing now, is the cyber war of between Russia and Ukraine escalating exponentially? I address this to say that a significant problem that I'm finding is how the U.S. strategic planners for supposedly wanting to prevent or threaten Russia so that they don't invade were talking a lot about how sanctions are going to be so crippling, that Russia will be hit with such sanctions it will go spinning. Well, guess what? I talked about this. Any 19-year-old who just started university would take Economics 101 and would be able to determine with certainty that the moment Russia invades the Ukraine, unless the sanctions are universally strangling the Russian economy, Russia will make money, will raise its revenue because of the price of oil going up, oil and gas. So this is something the U.S. strategists knew ahead of time. They knew the sanctions will not make an impact. They knew the sanctions will not prevent or make Russia think twice before invading. In fact, one of the topics we'll be talking about today is that how the ruble has actually normalized to its value prior to the invasion. Clearly, with all due respect to the U.S. government statement of calling the crushing sanctions, the sanctions have not been crushing, nor did they deliver what was supposedly to deliver, is the deterrent on Russia so that it doesn't invade. The other item that I find very, very worrying here is that the fact that these hacks were done in secret. In other words, the FBI, having court orders, yeah, that's the word I was looking for. They secured court orders to be able to do this. But these secret court orders only have jurisdiction in the United States. If the FBI actually was getting into service from companies that are not American companies or that are operating in other jurisdictions, those court orders have no legal validity. So what did the FBI do? So it raises a lot of issues. And one last thing that I have to put it, and I will open it up for the conversation, and I think Sam may want to interject something if I forgot something, Gunta, the same thing. My main concern here is the transparency of and the accountability of our governments in democracies, in Western democracies, plus the role of our media and our journalists to hold them to account. What I find bizarre and worrying here is if the two are working in sync and they are scratching each other's back and not giving us the information we need to have, then that actually puts our democracy under threat. And that's why I'm raising the concern. So I think these are my immediate thoughts, Sam. If you want to interject and add something that I may have missed and remind me of it, please do. Gunta, same thing to you.
Yes, thanks for that, Khalid. So the thing that I wanted to bring your attention to and ask your opinion about is the fact that the article states that President Biden has repeatedly said that he is not going to engage into direct combat with Russian forces on the ground. However, in cyberspace, this definition and this restriction does not apply. And they're talking here about a preemptive cyberstrike. So what do you think about preemptive cyberstrikes and the whole hacking back situation, which is so important for cyber war situation?
You know, it's a very good question, and one of the things that I believe, and I could be mistaken, I believe that most people who are in this room and people in the around the world are probably not aware, majority of them not aware of, that Russia proposed a cyber treaty to the U.S. to be done through the United Nations, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it was in 2017. It was ignored. It was only, I think, last year when the United States started wanting to see what can be done in terms of having some kind of a cyber treaty that limits everybody. And that's because the United States recognizes or knows now that despite its advances and its ability to be superior in technology to others, to other nations, it does not mean that it is not capable of being damaged. In other words, nobody will come out of this unscathed. In fact, every participant stands to be seriously, seriously damaged. Nobody will be a winner. So the fact of the matter here is President Biden, with all due respect to him, and I hope he will drink a bit more coffee. Maybe he'll wake up when he's talking about things, especially when he called Ukraine, if I remember correctly, recently. It needs to be the position of not having any confrontation in military terms between Russia and the U.S. is critical, because that could escalate to a nuclear confrontation. But the cyber stuff is far more sinister, because it is capable of escalating while nobody sees bullets and explosions taking place. And this takes us into the geopolicyber warfare that I keep talking about. It's already happening. And I labeled it, I talked about this in the previous session. I talked about how we are currently in what I have labeled many years ago, the silent, undeclared WW3. That's because no bombs, no explosions are taking place when cyber attacks are taking place, because ordinary people just carry on through their normal life, going to work, coming back from work, until either their ATM machine stops working, or their water supply stops functioning or gets contaminated, or their critical national infrastructure is no longer capable of giving them light or heat in the house, or they got stuck in the elevator while the electricity was switched off because of a major cyber attack. Unfortunately, this is a recipe for more disasters, and I cringe at the thinking of those who are strategizing this chess game at the White House and at the Pentagon, and how it was allowed to escalate. It all needed to be make Ukraine a neutral country, so that neither Russia feels threatened, nor the U.S. or NATO can feel threatened, and we could have saved so many thousands of lives and the death and destructions in Ukraine, and turning it today into the breeding ground of extremists, of Christian and Muslims, with the rise of the neo-Nazis and the transportation of the ISIS fighters from Syria into Ukraine. This is a big concern, and I tell you what, I'm flabbergasted why neither the French nor the Germans are speaking about this, because all of this happening in Ukraine, on Ukrainian territory, with all of this extremism, and the neo-Nazis is on the doorstep of Europe. You're not going to be able to stop this filtrating through Eastern and Western Europe. This is not going to stop there. Look what happened to Syria. Look what happened to the Middle East. So that's my 2 cents. It's more like 5 cents now, Sam. Gutta, something you want to add?
Well, I think in all that also there is quite a big issue, which is called trust and accountability and transparency. How that's going to be? Because if we can't trust our governments, our institutions, we don't have any evidence of anything. At the end of the day, they talk, they say, and we don't get anything.
That's a very, very. I mean, Gutta, you just hit it on the head. The biggest concern from all this is, what does the average citizen think about way his governments or her governments is functioning and whether they can trust them. I mean, we don't know, we haven't forgotten the myths, the purpose disinformation when it came to the COVID-19 and the vaccines and the storylines, the stuff that were called conspiracy theories in the first days of COVID as a pandemic. It turned out that many of them became true. People said, oh, I see, you know, they've lied to us so many times. It is no wonder that in Western democracies, the average citizen is so disengaged with politics that when elections take place, you barely get 30-33% of those who can vote that vote. It is any wonder that the youth, the young people who should vote, it's their future on the line, are so disengaged with this. So trust is at the core because, look, let's consider trust in the from a personal relationship point of view. If you're in a relationship and somebody betrays you once, might give them a chance one more time, provided they make up for it and they are far more transparent. Fine, maybe that will work. But if they repeatedly betray your trust, how much longer would you keep them? And the answer is not for long. But why are we keeping our public officials in power? Why do they keep staying for one term, two terms, three terms? Why do they get majority in their parliaments? It's baffling to me while they are betraying our trust repeatedly. That's my answer to that, Guta. And by the way, anybody who wants to who has a question, they want to raise some other issues for this conversation, please let us know.
Raise your hands and we bring you to the stage to share your thoughts. I have Tina coming up. Tina is a journalist and from Finland, and she also runs a newsroom in the mornings in Clubhouse.
Hello, Tina.
And this is the Cyber War and Geopolicy Warfare Club. Please follow the club and the moderators and find the topics and discussions compelling. Share with your friends and join the group and the debates, please.
Tina, the microphone is with you.
Hi, everybody. Good evening. It must be. No, it's for you morning because for us in Europe and also for Guta, it's evening. Excellent topic. I just have to inform you, I'm a Finnish citizen, and of course we follow carefully at the moment the discussion and debate of NATO membership, because probably Finland and Sweden will join NATO, and they will also inform citizens the application, because there's a framework going on. So back to the cyber attack, we just have Finland today, a very serious cyber attack, and it came just at the same time when President Zelensky was giving his speech to our government. And this is the last weekend, of course, when government members, parliament and president of Finland are doing their framework also for NATO membership. So there is a framework going on behind the scenes, discussion, debates, and a lot of diplomacy, because next week, 14th of April, this framework will be released. And it will tell us, all the citizens, transparently in Finland, what are the risks and to enjoy NATO, join NATO's, and what are the risks not to join. So this happens, and this was very serious, this cyber attack, because it lasts many hours, more than 2 hours, and it was against our government's websites. Mm-hmm. Yes, and it was against also government's defense department websites, and also our biggest bank. So there were customers who couldn't see their bank account for mm-hmm. a few hours.
Yes.
So Finland is a high technology country, and having only 5.5 million people, there's been such, they call it a comprehensive security program. So cyber attacks and hyper influencing has been predicting very well, but everybody asked me, are we afraid of Russians invading Finland? No, we are not afraid of that military invasion, but cyber attacks will be very, very, I will say, daily concerns in the future. I'm really happy to hear you and having this room, because I'm not a specialist of cyber attacks, but I'm learning every day.
Thank you for sharing this with us. Actually, if I may, and I'm not going to ask you anything personal, but I, as a Finnish citizen, your opinion on this matters, and I think you've clarified part of it, is in terms of the your feeling as a Finnish citizen, do you feel being part of NATO will make you safer or less safe from Russia?
Okay, I know it's not topic of this room, but let's say it's about security. 70% of the Finns and Swedes agree our favor in NATO membership. This changed, it changed radically during 1 month. Before it was 30% I'm pro peace person, but I changed my opinion in 2-3 years ago when we saw how Russian was changing. Yes, because we saw when they annexed Crimea. We saw also human rights questions, and we saw many journalists were killed there, and we saw rhetoric which was very scary, because that rhetoric was kind of a propaganda, and it was also it was addressed to several countries what Russian wanted to dehumanize, and of course Finland as an independent country 83 years after having war with Russia, we don't accept any kind of other country to give us rules what to do and how to vote and who to vote.
Absolutely right. And I think, and you know, it's interesting. First of all, thank you for sharing this with us. You know, I asked you, I put you on the spot because I asked you personal opinion, and you know, someone's personal opinion is their private thing. But thank you for sharing this because it's interesting how you, regardless of the fact whether it's the topic of the room, but it's a great value to the topic itself of transparency. How before the Ukraine invasion by Russia, what you, if I understood you correctly, the mood of the citizens in your country to join NATO was about 30%. It's jumped to 60%. Am I not correct? Did I hear you correctly?
Yes, you are.
Okay. And that tells me it's a very natural instinctive reaction by citizens when they are in fear of something. But at the same time, there's no way even though I have certain expertise in certain fields, I don't claim to know everything about everything. Nobody can know that. So you have to rely on the sources you get information from. And quite often, we are led to believe certain things. And I'm one of those people who, at the time when the U.S. was talking about Saddam having weapons of mass destruction, I truly believe the U.S. You know why? Not because they had the evidence, because we know who sold it to him. We know who gave it to him. The U.S. gave it to him when he was fighting and during the war of Iran. So, and then we find out that it wasn't there. My sense here is the issue of security to nations need to be looked at in a from multiple lenses. It's absolutely critical for Sweden and Finland to feel safe. But at the same time, none of these issues were a big matter maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago. By the way, I'm not defending the invasion. Absolutely not. I think, many of you who know where I was born in Syria. my country was decimated because of false narratives that had nothing to do with democracy. And so many of my people were killed and so much of the country was destroyed. However, to continuously threaten the national security of a country and expect them not to react is foolish, absolutely foolish. And I bring to the attention of everybody, President Kennedy was ready to press the nuclear button in 61 during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he did so because he was not going to permit the Soviet Union and Khrushchev to put nuclear missiles in Cuba on the doorsteps of the United States. Absolutely not. He was willing to go to war, nuclear war. And that is really fundamental. Nations that have certain strength to themselves will say, you're not going to do this on my back door. And I truly believe we have been poking Russia since the fall of the Soviet Union and put them in a position where they have no other choice. This is an excuse. There's no excuse for the invasion, but the blame has to be on all parties involved. That's the way I see it. So the fact that prior to the invasion, 30% of the public in your country, Tina, did not feel the need or the elevated need, to call it that, for a greater sense of security by joining NATO, tells me that people felt safer. And because you felt safe, Russia felt safe, and there was no need to do more. Today, everything is heightened, and everybody is now needing to do more to feel safer. And cyber is the area where we are all so vulnerable. And anybody that, like I said before, anybody that thinks they can engage into this and be unscathed, they are dreaming. This could be the true apocalypse if we allow this to escalate. My two cents. But thank you for sharing with us your thoughts, Tina.
Thank you. I totally agree with you. Thank you, Khaled.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Guta, anybody else in the room?
Yes, we have Richard. Hello. Hi, Richard. Welcome.
Hello, Guta. And thank you, Tina, for leadership and public action. And I've been inspired by your efforts here and Khaled. Awesome.
Thank you, Richard.
I guess there's two thoughts in my mind regarding this topic in the article pinned. Well, one is that the court was sought and granted the actions of the U.S. government to preempt this attack. It is legal, but I always worry that, of course, technology is way ahead of law. Law lags tech in its sophistication and ability to address these technologically sophisticated situations. And the other is that the sophistication of these state actor attacks and other efforts, shall we say, are so sophisticated as to require a coordination between industry and governments and, you know, private actors and even citizens. And it's too sophisticated to versus, you know, thousands of actors with state sponsorship. So they're not on the state payroll, but they're just acting on the behest with the blessings of the state. So regarding
Absolutely correct. Please go ahead, yeah.
And I looked just thanks to this room for inspiring me to look at the details of the hack. I've worked 15 years as a software developer and with a lot of cybersecurity concerns for web applications. And this particular attack is not actually web related. It's called Cyclops Blink. And it is a long known weakness in these what's called lightweight HTTPD servers. So on routers, mostly from ASUS, a big company in Taiwan, but it's a major manufacturer, is this particular set of software, and it has a known weakness. And of course, routers are at the edge of networks, so they both can see into a small network, you know, usually your house, you are in a small office, and they can also act outbound towards the public internet without interfering with the internal, you know, computers behind it. So a router, when it's compromised, is quite a personally dangerous thing from a network topography perspective. And because you never update the software on a router, and it's kind of challenging to update if you go to your home router and try to update the software, it's a pain. You might have to log in as administrator and then hit this download, and then it has to spend a lot of time rebooting, and who wants to do that? Or you could flash it, which is even more annoying. Anyway, it's not really updated. So it's security flaws and continue, and then you don't buy a new router for like, you know, 5 or more years. So this particular attack is very sophisticated. It uses so many layers of weaknesses in simultaneously, and dependent on the scale at which it would have been done if it wasn't preempted, would have been really hard to stop. Like once it got going, you couldn't be like, oh, let me just shut down a few routers in America. No. So that's why I think the scale of action that the FBI conducted was wise and thankful. But it's hard. It's going to be hard for everyone to understand this, even me as a professional in the field. It's going to be hard for governments and lawmakers to know what to do about this. It's going to be hard for the governments to keep up because they got to hire top talent and keep up. And it's going to be hard for state actors because it's quite a arms race. I mean, U.S., our best country in the world still, is very good. But, of course, Russia and other actors are giving us decent run. So that's all I had on my mind.
No, thank you, Richard. I think thank you for your comments. I think that's very, very valid. And I think if I remember correctly, and I'm going to paraphrase what you said at the beginning, which goes to the heart of the point you raised and the concerns that we both will probably share, is that how the law is not just seldom, not just often, always so far behind the advancement of technology. But there's something else. There's something really else. And here's the thing. Yes, the action would have been legal because a court order would have been secured. Granted. However, the court order would have been specific, or perhaps we hope the court order would have been specific of what the action the FBI could undertake. And hopefully it would have limitations. We don't know what those limitations or specificities that would have been. More importantly, because the core topic of what we're talking about here is transparency, accountability, and trust, and because our public officials and law enforcement agencies have actually lied to us in the past, despite the court order, we do not know if those hackers who acted legally because of a court order on behalf of the FBI removed what they were supposed to be removing only or planted something else along the way. This is critical because at that point, I tell myself, well, how do I know? It's like you go to a restaurant, and I'm sure most of us, you go to a restaurant and you order food, and the waiter or waitress will say to you, anybody has allergies? They want to make sure that you don't sue them because they asked the question. You didn't tell me you have allergies, and now you're sick. We don't know. We don't have any confidence. I personally don't have any confidence that the law enforcement agency that has been granted this court order went in and ordered just the pizza with cheese and tomato only and nothing else as hopefully specified by the court order. I don't know they've slipped in any other ingredients. And that keeps me concerned. Thirdly, I raised another point earlier on. The court order within the United States gives jurisdiction for the FBI to do what it's supposed to do, hopefully, for American companies or American citizens. Does not give them jurisdiction outside of the United States. So the report talks about around the world. Did that mean they also went into Finnish companies or Brazilian companies or Saudi companies? We don't know that. And that actually raises some other concerns. And I think we need to know this stuff because this is how we are going to be able to make judgment on whether our public officials and our law enforcement agencies are acting within the law and whatever, even if the law is a bit outdated, but they have to act within the law, not on their own whim. History has told us they've worked and done things a lot on their own whim. And that's another session. So thank you, Richard. I hope you also agree.
I totally do. Now, the sophistication of writing such a court order, I could not imagine. It's so complicated. But
Richard, let me put it in perspective. Judges, and you have some judges who are experts in different fields, from divorces to cyber. But even the best of the best may not necessarily know such specifics of what to limit the court order to be, and that leaves loopholes.
Amen to that.
You know, that's like when we talk about, did the officer have probable cause before he entered the house? Well, what's probable cause? It's his own opinion of what he felt was legal to enter. So this goes to that. And we are in such level of sophistication, the survivability of our humanity is at stake. And I don't want to leave it to the whim of somebody who believes he has the authority because somebody elected him or somebody appointed him. And because we do live in Western democracies, you know? And I keep talking about this all the time, and I hope I'm not preaching to the choir, because it is because we live in Western democracies, because we have laws and constitutions that have this enshrined in, that protects our liberties and our rights. And unless we hold these officials to account based on this, we have no chance. This is the only way we're going to win. First of all, democracy is going to survive. Otherwise, it's going to go down the toilet. It's already in what I've called it for the last 10 years. It's in stage 4 cancer. And unless we do something along the lines, then we're really going to be, I don't know if we can use the word screwed, but I'll just use the word screwed. So, Guta, maybe we can give the floor to the next intervention, please.
Okay. So we have Skyed Flow. I hope I had said your name right. Please come up with your question.
Hi, I didn't really have a question anymore, so I'm new to all of this, and the room actually, I accidentally popped into it, so I'm going to first say, like, thanks for having the room. I'm actually reading up now, trying to catch up a little bit, because I'm just now getting into cyber myself, so I think my first comment overall would be, I agree with the complication of writing something of this caliber, and I definitely want to speak to how we're always behind technologically versus the law. What I look at now more so is the protection of our information. It's the reason that I got into cyber. We have malicious actors, obviously, but I think we're more with, you know, actors and those that are organized, per se. Script kiddies and people that may or may not want to get into your bank account are probably not the worst people in the world right now, versus those who will do things like hack a pipeline or increase the sodium content in the water. And I think that it shows our security posture, but it also shows just where they're really putting their resources. And I think that's what I kind of wanted to highlight. If we can see the weaknesses that we have, but we can make the efforts that we have, I think we really, really need to harden ourselves before we write quick search, you know, write court orders such as this, because it does make us a target. When you say we stepped out into the world and defended them against Russia, pretty much, well, does that now open us back up to the very same pipeline attacks and things that we already proven we've had trouble defending from against before? I really think it's a strategic thing we need to consider.
You're absolutely right. So forgive me, I don't know how to say your name, because your name looks like it's a gangobbling. Skate Flow. What's your first name, Skate?
You just call me X.
X, okay, fair enough. The important part here is, and why we want to discuss this in the public format that we are, because, you know, in actual sense, you know, within my group and the work that we do on survivability and the cybersecurity and the geopolitics and the clientele that we have, whether they're governments or organizations at the highest level, this conversation needs to be at the public and the general public point of level, because there needs to be no more excuses that the laws are out of date. We hear this all the time. I hear this all the time. And I've been involved in some international treaties at the highest level. But the point of the matter here is, it is no longer an excuse to say, well, the law is out of date. The reason why the law is out of date is because laws are drafted and prompted and toned down and watered down because they first start with the essence of what needs to be done to safeguard society and citizens and stakeholders and businesses, etc. But then they start getting watered down because of special interests and businesses who don't want to do more because it's more expensive. And then they end up calling it, well, let's follow best practice. Well, guess what? Best practice belongs in the toilet, ladies and gentlemen, because best practice leaves it to the company itself and the organization to believe, to do what is necessary, they think what's necessary, not to do what must be done. And that opens up the this is why our laws are so out of date, and they never have a chance to catch up. Now, does that mean laws can be up to date all the time? The answer is no, but they can be better up to date. And part of the rationale here is, as citizens, it is our responsibility to actually push on reconciling, for our society to reconcile between the advancement of technology, which to a large extent can be a force for good, but has been a tremendous force for bad and abused by certain powers, and the reconciling this with better laws that can actually protect us and maintain advancement of technology. Just accepting it as de facto that out of date, but guess what? We're still functioning with in the system as a being out of date. Now, the last part I would add to what you just said, which I agree with, is we need to become more aware of our responsibility as citizens, because when our public officials act in a certain way, they are acting in our name. When their appointees act in a certain way, they are acting in our name. And when they do that, if we don't hold them to account and we identify those who are doing good, we reward them and keep them, well, those who are doing bad, we kick them out. But how come many of these politicians are in office for 10, 20, 30 years and they are known to be corrupt?
You know what? I can definitely answer to that. And also for me, and I definitely don't want to preach to the choir here, but I'll take any help. We live in not necessarily a democracy. In my opinion, I think we live more in a capitalism. And I understand the difference in those categories, I think, in terms of how you would define a nation and advancement. But I think the focus and the resources are aimed at capitalism. And yeah. I use this example to say, Eternal Blue is one of my favorite exploits. They said it was written by the NSA. So it goes to tell you, we have extremely good capability. But if we're only focusing on protecting the Federal Reserve router, if we're only worried about that network or the Social Security network, but we're not worried about making sure, if we're not worried about requiring that Walmart and T-Mobile, it's a chain that you just addressed. We gotta force these people to adhere to the requirements and make it an issue when they don't. But what happened? Insurance. And where did that come from?
You're absolutely right, and your distinction is very, very astute. The difference between whether we live in a democracy or whether we live in a state of capitalism. In fact, and this is not a plug, you will all be very happy, and some of you may know of this, my book, which is upcoming in a matter of weeks, is called Survivability. We will post a link for you to address this, to at least go and see what is it we're talking about. And I actually, in one of the chapters, I talk about this in great depth, about how supply-side economics and capitalism, or unfeathered capitalism without any social responsibility, is to a large extent responsible for many of the failures and our political, legislative, democratic, and many functions of society. And I can give you evidence of this. And by the way, for anybody who has studied economics, I was a student of none other than the creator of the Laffer curve, Dr. Arthur Laffer. And I talk about this in my book. And you will, when you read the book, you'll see what I talk about. Back in 1981, where I challenged supply-side economics being a bit missing, challenged my professor, who remained a very good friend, by the way, still is, challenged my professor on that, why supply-side economics will fail when normal functions of society cease to operate normally. And when we ended up in the debate in the class in front of 120 students, and he said to me, what's the problem with that? I said to him, the supply-side economics is missing a a critical variable, which doesn't exist in it. He said, what's that? I said to him, social responsibility. That was 1981, ladies and gentlemen. And I then drew to the attention of the failure of the failure of the economic, the 2008 financial collapse that hit the whole world. And at the core of that is because people were willing to sell contaminated debt that they knew is worthless, but they, because somebody else was willing to buy it, they would buy it because they had no social responsibility. It was purely based on greed, and nothing has changed. So you're now preaching not only to the choir, you're talking to those who have been preaching to the choir, and I totally agree with you. And unless we bring back the true values of democracy we claim to profess to the world, we have no chance against other systems. No chance.
Do you know what I want to highlight, actually, because we're in this conversation?
Go on.
And this is what I will say. I'm not really involved with Anonymous. I would love to be, their caliber, but I want to take what you just said about the responsibility of citizens earlier and make two very good points.
Go ahead.
It is the responsibility of us to hold our people accountable. And we have trouble doing that because of the government we live in, and I understand that. But the one thing I think that the government also realizes is the people that are capable of doing those things, they needed people. The government wasn't capable of saving the world from Russia's attack. It was the people, us. It was us doing our civic duty. And I want to charge all of us in here to do what we continue to do. Spread the information. Do not be fooled. We all understand the basic facts of what we were inherited with in this nation. And for me, my mission, I'm a hacker. So what am I going to expose misinformation when I can? And I think that's where we get into these topics, because it's not always about, ooh, I can run this script and screw their routers up. Well, do something more productive for your government. Do something to help people.
Absolutely. In fact, you will find it of value to go and read some of what we post on civility.news. We don't have a single ad of Google, by the way. It's purely to inform the public. And last but not least, Kuta, could you do us a favor, please? Could you post the link of the Survivability book so that people can see it in this group, and they'll be able to register for the updates, so when the book is ready for advanced purchase, they can pick it up and place orders, and at least read the synopsis and why the book is being, it was being written in the first place. Could you do that, please?
Yes.
Thank you. Who else is next?
We have Delta in the room, so Delta, please.
Delta. I'm assuming it's not Delta Airlines, is that correct,
no,
Delta?
No, not Delta. Delta's actually a dog that we had, and unfortunately passed away, so yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
You can see
no,
the picture.
Oh, no, I'm a dog lover.
Yeah, the beautiful Alsatian German Shepherd. X, if I can take you up on one thing, you talk about the people, the hackers, who can solve the problems, stop the war. The unfortunate thing about the current situation is the war is wrong, but it didn't need to happen. If Russia had approached NATO and the respective parties to ensure that Ukraine would never enter NATO, and they never gave them the reassurances that they were looking for. But at the same time, they told Zelensky, and he said that publicly, that he had been told categorically that Ukraine was not entering NATO. This war was unnecessary in many respects.
Absolutely right, Delta. Absolutely right. Absolutely right. They lied to both sides.
They lied to both sides. They provoked
the war. We lied to both sides. Let's call it. We lied to both sides.
And it's not just. It's now. It's thousands of millions of people are suffering. Ukrainians the most, but then people are going to starve in Africa. The wealth gap now has dropped, increased dramatically now in Europe because of the rising cost of living. Inflation is worse than it's reported. So the situation is a global one, or it's a Western one, because Asia is able for the moment now to isolate itself and in many respects benefit from what's going on to the detriment of the rest of us. But it's an unfortunate situation. This war should never have happened and didn't need to happen. And there was politics playing, there was ego, there's self-interest. The only winners in this industry are the military complex. They're making money hand over fist by manufacturing more arms. and the American economy by selling LNG to Europe at inflated prices and breaking contracts that they had with Asia.
And you want to know what? How do we hold them? I think what I was getting at, and I like you, why you made that point, hold, you know, the hackers that make the difference, honestly, the information you're giving is probably publicly available and it's probably somewhere where people could read it. But you want to know what happens in other areas? You know, they cut off that type of connection. You know, they stop or they try to block or even in America.
Let me interject here, X and to the Delta. I agree with both of you. And here's an important point that even should make us realize how it's far graver than what you both said absolutely eloquently correctly. In the early week or two of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Western media, especially in the United States, and I'm talking about the Foxes and the CNNs, both sides, those are the sides who actually hate each other. They were agreeing on one narrative, and that narrative was labeling the invasion of Ukraine by Russia as unprovoked. Both of them were reciting this very false narrative. And to the average American, this is the storyline that was sold, how the war was totally unprovoked. And the truth of the matter here is, this is a lie, which brings me back to the point as, how are we gonna hold these people to account, our public officials? If the media, in the pillar of the pillar of democracy around the world, or so claimed, is actually bought and sold and is delivering this absolute lie that's brainwashing the average American citizen, that's not allowing us to
and
actually...
And that is where our job comes in with, you know, the misinformation.
So, X, here's where I draw my point from this. If you come across any information that is of validity to hold public officials to account, reach out to me. We will publish it on Survive Radio News after we've authenticated it. Do you understand me? This is what part of my quest. Every news publication today is held back by the model that it needs to make revenue from advertising. And if their advertisers stop paying, they go out of business. Correct? Well, guess what? I don't have a single advertiser. I don't need to advertise. I'm doing it because this is my public service to the public good. So if you guys come across anything that is worthwhile, that is really capable of holding somebody to account, that will expose it, come to me. And we will authenticate it and we will publish it. And we've done this, by the way, we've done this in the past, even before I became the publisher of Survivor News. There are many stories that we passed on to the press, the Guardian, the Times, etc., that ended up becoming exclusives. But now we are holding these officials to account. So you're absolutely right, Ed. This is one way we can buck the system, because the system in itself is so corrupt and so cancerous, it has no chance of being of any utility to bringing a better world. My two cents.
Khalid, if I can jump back in.
Please.
I agree 100% with what you said. I think the role that Anonymous and the others pay or play in this game is critical, but you've seen what happened to Snowden, and now to Assange. I mean, what's happening to him, I think, is criminal.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. And listen, you're absolutely right. And let me put it this way. I have no illusions. I can't say anymore. I have no illusions. Everything I try to do, the stuff that can be disclosed publicly, I disclose publicly. People know. And by the way, if anybody ever finds out that, I'm not well or something happened to me, I have no suicidal tendencies. Let me go on record here. But I do have a quest of doing what is my civic duty in a country where the citizen is supposedly counts, and beyond just voting. So it is my civic responsibility to actually hold my politicians to account. So, thank you.
If I can go back to the subject of cybersecurity and add a couple of things in relating to what we've got. Politicians, in terms of why aren't they enacting the laws, and doing what needs to be do in terms of cyber security is, I don't mean to be cynical, but you find it throughout many countries, is that most of the politicians are just totally unqualified for the task that they're asked to do. They just don't have the background. They don't have the expertise. You correctly pointed out is that they're swayed by lobby. And most of the big, let's say, social media and Google, it's not in their interest to put in the right infrastructure to ensure that we are all protected. The sad thing about the politicians, another thing is that, and again, I'm a cynic, is that a lot of this war, and you take Boris Johnson or even Biden, their home popularity with COVID and how they've managed their economies was such a disaster. They needed a war. Boris Johnson is loving this moment at the moment because he's now being portrayed as a Churchillian individual in terms of how he's dealing and leading the charge against the Russians. And it's only going to backfire.
Whereas only a week ago, they were asking for his vote. Absolutely.
Yes, exactly.
Because so it, right to Parliament.
Yep. And many of the other Western politicians or European politicians are following the same suit because they're detracting from the domestic problems. In many countries now,
absolutely
people are looking to vote more to the right because Le Pen may actually win come Sunday. It's a possibility, and that's a frightening one because it changes the balance of Europe. It changes the perspective of Europe versus Ukraine because Le Pen is quite favorable towards Russia and China and other elements. So right. It has a major impact. And the politicians have been asleep by saying, oh, but the public wants to know. The other main point in terms of what I've never understood with cybersecurity is what I call the digital redundancy element that is built into systems, whether it's a power plant, if it's attacked, it's hacked. It goes down.
Yes.
People's lives are at risk. Why the systems do not have a redundancy on a digital basis, on an analog basis, built into the infrastructure, where you can still operate it, but on an analog infrastructure versus a digital. I don't get it. It's possible. It's achievable. It just means that people have to be on site. They have to know what they're doing. And then you have to immediately have to apply to the backup system that every system should have, and it may have a 24-hour time delay or an hour delay, depending on it.
That's not good for the company's profit margins.
It's not good, and this is where I'm a capitalist in many respects, but I'm a total socialist when it comes to there are certain services that should be owned by the state, from transportation to utilities, power, water, and the likes. So that these are never interrupted, never affected, and helped. And I think
Delta, sorry to interrupt you.
It's already like that because businesses get those types of things. You don't hear about Georgia Power's actual power being cut. You don't hear about the White House's water bill being cut or anything. Why? Because they provide that resource to the person that they want it to. They just don't think the citizens are worth that same treatment.
No, this is also true, but the fundamentals here is the problem that we're facing today is this. We have a lot of challenges, let me put it this way, and I think we need to pick where we focus our attention because the goal needs to be how do we change this corrupt system? That's really the bottom line. It has so many problems on so many levels, and each one of us can at least recite at least 20 major problem, but we can't deal with all of them at the same time. We need to chip at the system that will give us, we need to chip at the problem in a way that allows us to create progress. And one of the fundamental points here is we need to make the citizen more informed and less disinformed.
But there's no accountability. I mean, apologies for interrupting.
No, please.
There's no accountability. I mean, at the moment, the biggest lie that's going on with the Ukrainian situation is that Europe can decouple itself from Russian gas, oil and gas. It just can't happen, not for the next 5 or 15 years.
You're absolutely right.
And they're lying to everybody. And everyone's thinking, yeah, we can switch off the gas. No.
At the beginning, when Sam, you probably weren't in the room, when Sam was reading the New York Times article and how the U.S. administration talked about the sanctions it imposed on Russia and calling it crushing sanctions. The sanctions are not crushing. In fact, one of the things, a topic of conversation that we had lined up for today was how the ruble has recovered its value and now it's equivalent to pre-invasion value. That is not a reflection of a crushing sanction regime. That is not a reflection of a successful U.S. administration strategy to prevent Russia from invasion. In fact, it was all rhetoric, and the fact that they lied to Zelensky, told them you're not joining NATO, while publicly they were telling the Russians and the world Ukraine is coming to NATO any minute, they created the sense of urgency for Putin to come in. The opposite of what they claimed they were doing. That's why I was talking earlier on about the economic model that any 18, 19-year-old would know that Russia was going to double its revenue or increase its revenue the moment it invades because of the price hiking, the price hikes in oil and gas, and because of the fact that sanctions will not absolutely strangle the economy of Russia because Germany, France, and many European countries depend on this. You strangle the revenue of Russia from that oil sold to European countries, European countries will actually starve to death. So, conclusion, this was known to the strategists at the White House and the Pentagon. They still labeled the rhetoric as crushing, they're going to do that. They knew all along this was not going to work. They threatened Russia that Ukraine was going to join at any time while telling Zelensky he's not going to join. All indicators tell you they created the invasion to happen. There's no, I do not believe that Russia and Putin would have wanted to invade unless he was in fear that at any minute Zelensky would send a letter to NATO that he wants to join and NATO members would approve it. The moment that would happen, ladies and gentlemen, Ukraine is untouchable. He had to go in before something like this happened. And who created that sense of urgency? Our lies. And who the thousands of dead civilians were totally unnecessary. And now Zelensky say, well, you know, we're willing to concede on being neutral. And it brings us to the next point, is that is anybody not watching the rise of neo-Nazism and Nazi groups in the Ukraine, many of which were blacked out and on social media like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and now they are no longer blacked out on these platforms. In fact, anybody saw the story about how Zelensky, who's been doing a lot of the tours talking to the parliaments around the world, he was addressing the Greek parliament yesterday. And he introduced somebody who was talking next to him, I believe he was talking next to him, who was a member of the neo-Nazis. And many of the Greeks were saying, this is totally offensive. This is unacceptable. This is who we are supporting. How could that be acceptable? And how could that be acceptable to Europe, who suffered at the hands of Nazism, and now these are the groups who are actually dictating what happens on the ground in Ukraine? It's not Zelensky. So it really makes me wonder: are we as a foreign policy in the United States or in Europe? Saying, well, you know, we'll shut a blind eye if neo-Nazis are doing things because it's the bigger advantage we want to gain. I mean, what happened to our values? I don't know. I'm asking the questions. Maybe nobody else is asking those questions, but I answer those questions. I think these are the questions we need to ask and hold our public officials to account. If we don't have any values, then guess what? We might as well go to the dog now.
Unfortunately, in the case of the U.S., they've been playing in Ukraine for a long time. They are responsible for the 2014 coup. So they know exactly the elements in the Ukraine. But again, the U.S. doesn't have a very good history of regime change. If you look at Iraq, you look at Iran, you look at Libya. So this is another situation. It is another regime change that they fostered. Zelensky is doing a fantastic job in the media. I have no doubts he's being briefed and managed and by the CIA and other elements, and he's winning hearts and minds. But when the truth comes out, ultimately, it's going to backfire on a lot of people. And the other bad news is that the Bidens are knee-deep in Ukraine. They have dirt on him. They have dirt on the two Bidens. And that will also come out. But people have been sitting on that for a long time.
And no, just, that's absolutely
true. One final point that you meant about the ruble.
Please.
The irony is that ruble is potentially today the strongest currency in the world, in that it is the only one that is effectively backed by a commodity. Not in real value, but when Putin said, if you want my oil or my gas, you pay in rubles. It's effectively brought on, it's dollarized, it's where people used to talk about the petrodollar, it is now the ruble, the petroruble, in the more real sense than
anything else. This is absolutely correct. And yesterday I was having an in-depth conversation with someone, private, so I won't mention a lot of the details, but we were talking about what's likely to happen to the dollar. And by the way, nobody should take this as financial advice. But in my humble opinion, and I won't say professional, so nobody listens to the advice here and goes and buys dollars or sells dollars, but the current state of affairs of the value of the dollar today, where things are, and the fact that the dollar is backed by nothing other than the paper that the United States government or the Federal Reserve printed, leads us to the conclusion that any change in the usage of dollar as the denomination of transaction is going to have a direct impact on the value of the dollar and the demand and supply of dollars around the world. So case in point, Saudi Arabia now has seen how the US totally abandoned Afghanistan, and they started thinking, oh my God, what would happen to us if we have a problem? Many other countries are doing the same thing. So the Saudis have already established, have solid and well-established relations, economic and others, with Russia, but especially with China. In fact, the Saudi government is considering taking the Chinese currency as the form of payment for oil it sells to China. And at the same time, it's looking at investing its revenues in Chinese infrastructure and investments, and vice versa. China is doing the same. This is what these two countries are doing, so that their interdependencies increases the assurance of their economies and societies being able to withstand any blow. Now, any reduction in the need for dollars to buy oil by any state around the world, especially somebody the size of China, believe it or not, will have a direct impact on the value of the dollar. Same thing what Russia did. The amount of billions of dollars that are sold in oil in value to Europe, now no longer being requiring dollars to be purchased, requiring rubles, that also will have an impact. And one last point I will point out, and I hope the people at the White House and the Pentagon and the power brokers in the U.S. political system pay attention. Something I will say, this is not something I created, but Condoleezza Rice, the former national security advisor who presided the job during the tenure of George W. Bush, when she was doing her PhD at Stanford, and I'm paraphrasing now, I don't remember exactly the wordings, but she said something in her PhD that goes something along those lines. It says, when empires start collapsing or falling, they don't make announcements. Unfortunately, if we can treat the United States as an empire, it is an empire without a doubt, but if you look at its geopolitical influence and generally in the last 20 years and how that has shrunk and how we no longer have partners, we have puppets who work with us, majority of whom do it because they have been incentivized by having political leaders who benefit from this, not because it serves society. That actually makes me really concerned about the economic and the medium to long term economic and political prosperity of the United States, unless it changes direction in the way it implements many of the things. And I don't see the current players who hold the
brain of how this corrupt system is functioning, recognizing the need to change things. In fact, they are now becoming more and more desperate to do things so that they remain in the control that they are, not realizing that the empire is crumbling under them because of their mismanagement. That's my two cents.
All right, so can we call Anita now? She's been waiting here on stage. Anita, are you there?
Hey!
Hi, the stage is yours, darling.
I know, I can't be so smart. Wait, what are we talking about?
I mean, you asked to come to stage. Would you like to add something?
What are we talking about?
No, that's okay. If Anita doesn't have anything specific to add, that's fine. Thank you very much, Anita. I would like to
I would like to know what are we talking about?
I think, Anita, with all due respect, if you could read the synopsis of the topic that we are discussing, and then if you have something to share, then you can come in and request the microphone. It sounds to me like you were not aware and you're just getting on the microphone. So thank you very much. Gutta, anybody else we have? I think something else. Anybody else wants to add something about the ruble and the dollars as what I discussed just now? And one last other point. The link to the survivability of the book that's upcoming in the next few weeks is already posted there. Anybody who wants to know more about it, click. And I do strongly suggest you register for updates so you get alerted when we have events and book signing events that are taking place in different cities around the world, and also to become aware when the book launch date is announced, because it's going to be done imminently. Okay, Gutta, anything else we need to address that we haven't addressed that were on our radar?
No, I think we covered pretty much everything about transparency, and I think for me it's like to be honest, we have the question with democracy and the credibility of our institutions at task.
Yeah. So in that case, I think we've covered the topics we have. We've given the opportunity for those who want to interject their thoughts, and I always welcome those who want to contradict what we're doing and challenge us. Please do. So with that in mind, I would like to close by saying thank you for joining. Please, if you felt that this debate, these type of topics, this kind of conversation is of value to you, compelling to you, feel free to share the group, which we call the Cyber War and Geopoly Cyber Warfare. Share it with your colleagues, become a member. We will be having these events at least once a week, but there will be times when extenuating circumstances come up and it requires a serious conversation, which means these could take place within hours. So the best way to know is to do it is to be alerted. So please register, share this with your friends, and stay in touch. I think if there's nobody else that wants to have the floor to say a last statement.
Khaled Politico was up, and I think he had a glint in his back again.
Yes,
would you like to add something?
Yeah, Sahil, please go ahead if you have something to add, and please keep it brief. Thank you.
Okay, Politico is gone again. I think he has connection problems. Then we have Sahil.
Hello.
Hello, Sahil. Go ahead.
Would you like to add to the discussion?
Is there something you want to say, Sahil? Sahil, that was not coherent. Thank you very much. Anybody else? No? In that case, we will say thank you very much. We will close the session. Replays will be here for a short period of time, but then they will be posted on survivability.news, where you'll be able to listen in We'll record them and listen to them at your own convenience, and feel free to share them with your colleagues, and we'll take it from there. And until next time, we bid you very well, and we bid you farewell, and stay safe, and we'll see you next time.
And don't forget to follow our club in the Little Greenhouse and your moderators and each other, so we can start build this community with Khaled.
Thank you very much, Gutta, and thank you for everybody else.
Okay, one.